Good afternoon. I particularly enjoyed your talk, the previous speaker. You actually introduced or you talked about some themes that were very important with us and very important with the APHA. I think it was last year the theme was think global and act local. And then you introduced this notion of hands-on approach. And so in my talk, we're going to introduce perhaps or bring in some terms that you might not be completely familiar with, place-based, and that'll be one term. The other term is community-based participatory education as opposed to community-based participatory research. So I'm Dr. Britt from Chicago State University. We have no conflict of interest. This talk or this paper that we're presenting you has to do with the NCI, which funded the grant. The outline is, name of the our grant is Chicago Southside Cancer Disparities Initiative. We work very closely with our MPH program. We're big on community-based education and learning, and we have community partnerships and programs. So Chicago State is a minority-serving institution, and we have a collaboration with the University of Chicago, their Comprehensive Cancer Center. So we've been working with them for now about 3 or 4 years. Our grant was funded in 2012, and it goes through the 2016. I'm the principal investigator at CSU, and Dr. Karen Kim, who is at the University of Chicago, is the PI there. Our components are external and internal advisory committees. We work very closely with the committee, with the community rather, and we have a student leadership council. Most of you are familiar with the cancer disparities. Many people were talking about cancer disparities with breast cancer, and we know that the incidence of breast cancer is higher in the majority of the white community, but the mortality is higher in the black community, and you see the numbers there. There were a few years where we were about the same in terms of the mortality, but it is out of hand as of 2005. We like to say that we are the largest African American minority-serving institution in the Midwest. We have designated health professional shortage area. We have a STEM program. All of you are familiar with STEM. There are some people who want to add an A to STEM. I think the A is for for some other issue, which is escaping me now. For some reason, I'm having one of those moments. Okay. We have a minority biomedical research program. We have RISE. We have SCORE. All trying to improve the lot of our community. Our first cohort in our MPH program started in the fall of 2011. We focus on minority health and health equity, perhaps one of the few in the area that focus on minority health and health equity. We're engrossed in our self-study program as we speak right now. The University of Chicago has one of two designated comprehensive cancer centers in the state of Illinois. They have the largest number of minority enrollment in clinical trials, about 21% in the state, and they have established an Office of Community Engagement and Cancer Disparities, and this is under the direction of my colleague, Dr. Karen E. Kim. This is just a map of the south side of Chicago. The larger star there, the purple star, is University of Chicago, and then down the green star is Chicago State. It looks like it's a long distance, but it takes about 10 minutes to get from University of Chicago to Chicago State. We think that we should rethink disparities education. There is actually a number of people now who are not comfortable with the word disparities. They want to use health inequities or health equity, and we would agree with that. It's just we named our program Chicago Southside Cancer Disparities Initiative, but we are well on board with the notion of health equity. So disparagement courses are taught in the classroom, but the impact is intended, the intended impact is on the community. The grants specific courses utilize place-based, there's that term again, place-based, and what does that mean? We actually have what we call service learning sites where our students go out and do the practicum, and so we like to consider that place-based. Place-based education based on community, participatory education, that's the other term I said I would introduce. We're developing a community-oriented disparities curriculum, and somehow or another, Dr. Kim, the last line is a little confusing, but it says community town hall meeting and survey. We actually have an article that's coming out, and so I apologize for this bugaboo. Results. What are they saying? They is the community. We have learners, we have community partners. So what? What we did was we had several town hall meetings, and with the town hall meetings we also had clickers, and we asked specific questions to the community and they gave us an immediate response. And in these responses, it was upwards from 85 to 95%. Do you think the community should be involved in cancer disparities and curriculum development? They said yes to the tune of 80 to 95%. I apologize. I don't want to apologize anymore, but I will. Oh, there we go. There we go. I had to click it too. So there you go. 93%. And you will see only 7% said no. So the community does want to be involved, and we encourage that. We need that. And I think when we work very closely with the community, we're going to have better outcomes from the community. Are you interested in being involved in designing a cancer disparities curriculum for the MPH students? I've given it away, right? I've already said what the answer is. So let me just show you what they said. 85%. Next question. We had several, but we just thought we would pull out a few to show this audience. Would you want to take a cancer disparities mini course? Now, before we go anywhere, how many think this community really would want to do that, even though I supposedly have given away the answer? If you were a community person, would you really want to take a cancer disparities mini course? Can I see a show of hands? I see one, two, maybe four or five people who think they would want to take a mini course in cancer disparities. Let's see what the community said. 81%. And we didn't pay them to say this. Here's a word again. Place-based disparities, curriculum goals. How do we teach disparities in the classroom? How do we involve the community? They suggested we should walk in their shoes, we hear their voices, we see their neighborhoods, and that's part of our community practicum that our students go to in our various service learning sites. Place-based learning examples. In the fall of 2012, we have an agreement or an association with CCJD, Central Comunitario Juan Diego, and Project Brotherhood. We have students who have met with directors and staff at both the CCJD and Project Brotherhood to assess needs. Based upon express need, the students will create cancer risk reduction programs. We have a pre and post survey. It's not complete, but we have a pre and post survey will be administered to measure participants' knowledge, attitudes, and belief. And lastly, health educators at both facilities will be trained to deliver the programs in an effort to increase sustainability. We also had our MPH students under the direction of Dr. Watkins, we had our students develop a brochure, if you will. It's called Cancers Can Survive, and I thought we would put one word in front of it, you can survive, so we believe that you can survive cancer, and so we put together, or the students put together, this brochure called Blending Faith and Health for Hope and Healing. This is an example of what we try to do. Place-based courses, examples, again, Cancer Disparities Lecture Series. We've done that now from, I think, 2013 through this past academic term. And from the Cancer Disparities Lectures, we are developing a Cancer Disparities mini course for spring 2015. If we're lucky, we will start it in January. If not, we will start it in the fall. And the participants, of course, will be the MPH students, the medical students from the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine, and, of course, community members. We will have small group learning, and our topics, of course, will be cancer-specific, technical skills, grant writing, research skills and mentorship, and community activity capacity building. We're really big on working with the community. Our next steps, and this is actually, I think, my last slide. The next step is diversity supplements. Two of our junior faculty, if you will, have submitted a supplement to the NCI, and they were both approved. Dr. Watkins is dealing with belief-based systems, social processes, and colorectal cancer treatment. And Dr. Naylor is dealing with the diverse learners, interprofessional cancer disparities education. And that is it. I hope I didn't go too fast. Thank you. Are there questions?
Yep. So now we'll have about 20 minutes for questions and answers if all of our presenters will come up to the panel. And I will keep Dr. Britt's last slide because it says questions. Yes. Chicago Food Depository, but this one was already in the catchment area, and like I said, all
also access to healthier fruits and vegetables, and foods was one of the barriers. So when I was looking for community resources, that's how I found them. And not only did I find farmers markets, I also found food pantries, because we have certain food pantries in Chicago that people come from the community and line up as early as 1:30 to get food that they don't pass out to 3:30. And we went in and did a health promotion and health education during that time while they're just sitting there. So what I just did, I Googled, I called the Greater Chicago Food Depository, because there's certain qualifications that a venue might need to have to start one, but they will tell you what they need.
One second.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to your question. Your question was, how do you get a farmer's market in certain communities? Well, in some, in Chicago, we have some mega churches, and some of the mega churches have active ministries that deal with a variety of issues, and one of the issues is they have a farmer's market. And so if you work with the church, the church may have a ministry, or they may develop one based on the need that the community is bringing to them.
That's a really good question. I'm going to stand up so I'm not losing half the room here. In the context that I'm talking about reciprocity, I'm thinking specifically of the institution that's partnering at the community level, and how they're getting something from partnering with my institution. So in terms of the community itself, it matters. It's not to say that it doesn't matter, but we're sort of going for the low-hanging fruit first, which is that even institutional partnerships have not historically been reciprocal. Now, what we hope is that by partnering well with the institution, there will be positive reverberations throughout the community, but I don't think we've mastered that yet. I'd like to say we have some great success story, but any success stories we have are going to be at the individual level. It's really right now about even these institutional partnerships have been very imbalanced in who's getting something and who's giving something. So that's where we're trying to go first. But I appreciate your mentioning it, because I think that's like the 2.0 aspiration that we think next. Not at all. Yeah. So those are great questions. For those of you who might not have heard, the question is, how do we match a student to the site, and what say does the partner have? So what I've tried to create is really something that balances practicality with sticking with our philosophy of mutual respect. So the way that we do it is we have a number of ways that students can get to a partner. We have an internship program where we have some partners that say, I would like an intern to do this. And then that's the easiest format. And then we have some partners who say, I'd like an intern. I don't know yet what I want the intern to do, but I need someone who has roughly this skill set. And then we have some partners that say, I'll take a student and I'll figure out later how I could use them and send me anyone. So for the first thing is that I put out a call for students formally, and then I also informally scout students who come in just saying I want to do something. And I start looking to match them. One area is on skill sets. So does the student, if it's a research institute that needs a really quantitative skill set or someone with lab experience, we look for that. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes we want someone who has ethnographic training, even if it's just a little bit of it, or an ethnographic research orientation. We look for that. But something else that I screen all students for at the preliminary search stage is, are they humble? Are they culturally adaptable? Are they looking for a highly structured environment where they're given a set of instructions every day? Or are they looking for somewhere where they can really have room to move and grow? Because we have both kinds of partners. So we do a bit of personality matching. So what I do is I find a short list of good candidates, and then I pass those to the partner. What I used to do was send a whole list of applications to the partner. It was extremely burdensome. Because who wants to sort through 20 or 30 applications when you've got another job to do? So what I...
Applications to the program?
Yeah, to specific internships.
So they fill out an application
yep.
for a specific site?
Yes, usually. Sometimes it's more informal that we find them, but usually they're applying. So I pull the applications. I screen them to make sure that they're going to match on those preliminary characteristics. And then I give the short list to the partner and say to the partner, please choose if you want, and occasionally the partner says, can you just pick someone for me? But we really want it to be their choice unless they don't have the time or don't want the headache. Does that answer the question?
Okay, I have a couple questions. So you evaluate the candidates and then you select them. I am a student at the University of Arkansas, Medical Sciences, and I am currently volunteering for Translational Research Institute. And we're trying to collect research data on certain populations of current health issues that affects them in certain zip codes. And I find that we run into a lot of Hispanic populations that we don't have a bilingual person. But the ones that we can reach, sometimes they say, how are you getting them involved and getting them to disclose their health issues voluntarily?
What I've seen that really works the most is the peer-to-peer. We have people that look like them, that talk like them, that come from the same area. So we, like I mentioned in my project, we were doing on the south side of Chicago, so we got members from that community. And actually, this the larger initiative was improving diabetes care and outcomes in the south side of Chicago. It was predominantly supposed to be geared to African American. One of our clinics actually is in a community that's like half Hispanic and half African American. So we did have to get someone that spoke bilingual, you know, Spanish and English, and to change some of our things just to be appropriate for them, culturally tailoring it. Because that's really important.
Okay. And I don't know if I missed the part about I think you and Patricia mentioned about and you educate them on the proper foods to eat. Are you educating them on how to put a proper meal together? Because a lot of people, especially downtown, you know, they'll eat fried chicken, mashed potatoes gravy, and cornbread.
Okay.
So are you teaching them how to put a proper meal?
Right, because it's one thing, like we do a lot at the farmer's market and the grocery stores and food pantries, but it's one thing to give people food. You can give them all the free food that you want. There was even a study done in Chicago where they had given people on the west side pineapples, and they followed them home, and it was a trail of pineapples on the ground because they didn't have tools to cut them open or did they know how to do it. So we also educate them on that, to eat in variety and moderation, that no foods are bad for you, because too much of anything is not good for them. So we do all of that.
And how are you giving feedback from the community to see whether or not your program is actually working?
We have pre and post surveys, and then they come back almost every Saturday. We have frequent flyers that come, and then they participate in the whole hour tour, and they go to all of the different venues that we have. Yeah, so we have a lot of data on that.
Great. I think we have time for one more question.
Can I ask one?
Yes.
No one else has one?
Yeah.
So I have a question, another healthy eating question, which is, do you address the time that it takes to prepare a healthy meal versus, let's say, picking up fast food or some other choices that may not be as healthy? Because this is something that's always driven me crazy, is when your living reality is you leave one job, it takes you a long time to get home from that job, you've got your kids, maybe your grandkids, you've got to feed them, and then you've got to get to your next job. This whole, I've got to prepare a meal and clean up for it, is a real challenge. So have you had some successes with models to deal with that?
Yes, because it's all about planning. That's what we say, too. And cooking is work. Like a sidebar, my brother married a woman, and she said she didn't know how to cook. My mother said, yes, cooking is work, and you have to put some energy into it. And when people are working and going to school and doing a lot of things, we even suggest that they do like combination meals, like do something big on Sunday so they can maybe freeze some things and prepare for the other day through the week.
Yes, we'll open it for the public as well, for the community as well.
Is there anything else? Any other questions? Great. Well, one more round of applause for all of our presenters.